loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou, and joined in studio by our longtime host, Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Loud and Clear co-host John Kiriakou was invited to address the European Parliament in his capacity as a world-renowned whistleblower and human rights advocate, but his speech was canceled at the last minute. The Russiagate witch hunt strikes again. Next, Democrats are jubilant following their victories in last night's election. What does this tell us about the state of politics in the United States? And is the Democratic Party really on solid ground? Then, a leaked German government document has revealed the military's strategic planning for six geopolitical scenarios that could come to pass by 2040. What does the de facto leader of the European Union foresee for the bloc and the world? And finally, who's the real conspiracy theorist? The latest theme in the Russiagate frenzy is that anyone who questions the official narrative is on the fringe, unworthy of serious consideration. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to our special interview with John Kiriakou. He's usually here in the studio with us at Loud and Clear, where he's a co-host. But John Kiriakou today is in Brussels. He went there for the anniversary of the election of Donald Trump. I have to say, this is quite an amazing story. John Kiriakou, welcome to Loud and Clear. How are you?
Hey, thanks. I'm doing very well, thanks. Had a good day here in Brussels.
Very good. First of all, you were invited to come to Brussels to speak before the European Parliament. And just for our audience that might not know, John Kiriakou is a former CIA officer who went to prison for 2.5 years for having revealed to the American people and the world that the Bush administration had illegally instituted a policy of torture. And for that, the government came down on him like a ton of bricks. And so, obviously, John, in Europe, where people hate George W. Bush and hate torture and know it's illegal, you have a revered status. So you were invited to speak there at the European Union or the European Parliament on this anniversary. What happened?
I've been so fortunate, Brian, because and it's not just here in Brussels, but anytime I come to Europe, I'm treated just so well. Europeans have such a much deeper understanding of these issues of national security, whistleblowing and torture and drones and nuclear weapons, far, far more than Americans have in general. So I'm always treated very well here. I was supposed to appear on a panel this morning and then give a speech in the afternoon. The afternoon speech went on as planned. But unfortunately, I was removed from the panel after one of the other panelists objected to my presence. And disappointingly, that was the representative of the Bernie Sanders movement. They objected to the fact that I work at Sputnik, and they said they did not want to appear on a panel with me. So this woman said that she ran it up the flagpole at the Bernie campaign, and they told her that she was not allowed to appear with me. And so rather than cause a ruckus, I was quietly removed from the panel, and instead my panel time was converted into a one-on-one television interview for the Greek media.
So you flew to Belgium yesterday. You were here in the studio. In other words, you left Washington to fly to Brussels to give a speech or speeches, including at this panel. And someone from the Bernie Sanders movement said, I have to check back with headquarters to see if I'm allowed to speak in the same panel with John Kiriakou, the man who exposed torture, George W. Bush's torture program, and then went to prison for it. She had to check back with headquarters, and headquarters told her no.
Brian, it's so ridiculous on its face that I actually thought she was joking when she first said it. And I laughed when she said it. And she said, I'm serious. I can't be on this panel with you. She said, nothing personal. I think you should be proud for what you've done. But you work for Sputnik, and so I can't be on the same panel. And I said, wait a minute, you're serious about this? And she said, yes. And within 5 minutes, I was off the panel. I was never even asked about it. I was just removed.
I mean, it's really something because these same people used to be on Radio Sputnik. They were on our shows. I mean, loud and clear. We were very vigorously against Donald Trump. I mean, we were also critics of Hillary Clinton, but Bernie Sanders was a critic of Hillary Clinton, too. We were fiercely against Trump and all of his reactionary racist policies. So was By Any Means Necessary, Eugene Perrier's show. And yet, I really think this, the liberals in America backing away and refusing to be on a panel with someone like you, John Kiriakou, because you happen to be a show host at Radio Sputnik, a show that you, as you and I both know, because we co-host the show, nobody tells us what to say or what to do. It's just it's guilt by association. And it really is a kind of a danger to a fundamental democracy when even the so-called progressives self-censor or insist on the censoring of other voices, not because you did something wrong, did something bad, but because you're employed by Sputnik and doing an independent radio show. I mean, it's really a dangerous phenomenon.
And Brian, this is something that I think Americans are going to learn the hard way, because a lot of the questions that I fielded today from a variety of European nationalities centered on the fact that the United States seems to be easing its way into a new Cold War, but the Cold War has been initiated by the Democrats. This Red Scare is a Democratic invention, not a Republican one. And everybody wanted to talk about it.
Yeah, indeed. And you know, I was just watching a movie about the Hollywood 10, the 10 very famous producers and directors and writers and actors, all of whom were fired and actually sent to prison because the government insisted that they say under oath whether they were or were not members of the Communist Party or associated with the Communist Party. This was the late 1940s. These guys all went to prison. They were blacklisted then. They couldn't work for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. Some of them never worked again. The most prominent people in Hollywood, because of that witch hunt, you know, that was the Democrats too. I mean, that was the Truman administration that did all that. Of course, Eisenhower picked it up right where Truman left off.
Sure. And if you remember Pete Seeger was victimized by the Democrats in the 1950s as well, for exactly the same kind of reason. And if the man had not had the wherewithal and the ability to make children's albums and to perform at colleges and universities, he would have starved.
Yeah, Pete Seeger, "This land is your land, this land is our land." I mean, that's the Seeger song. Of course, the more radical verses are taken out, but all school kids learn that song. Pete Seeger and all of them were attacked, not because of something they did, but either because of what they thought, their ideas, like thought police, or because of association. I mean, I think it's an imperative need for people to stop being so opportunist that they decide, as she said to you, "I respect you, I admire you, but I can't speak in the same panel because you have a radio show."
It's like I say, it's so ridiculous that I thought it was a joke, but it's not a joke. And because it's not a joke, that makes it actually very dangerous.
You know, the Democrats are often painted as incompetent politicians, right? They're so weak and unable to do anything. And on the one hand, that's true when it comes to combating the right wing, right? I mean, certainly we saw in 2016, there's a huge failure against like the worst possible Republican candidate. And, you know, that certainly wasn't the first time it happened. This person, you know, was not like a Clinton fan, but, you know, they're representatives of a left-wing campaign that accepted the confines of the Democratic Party and liberalism as a political ideology, and they failed to take down the candidate to their right. But liberals are actually very effective and aggressive at combating their own left wing, right? The people who are to the left of them are actually very viciously and firmly attacked. I mean, it's not this kind of weakness and compromise that we see them demonstrate when it comes to the right wing, the conservatives, even the far right in U.S. politics.
Walter, that is such an important point. And, you know, it's not lost on the Europeans here. One member of the European Parliament from Spain said to me today when I was complaining about this whole incident, he said, "You know, Bernie Sanders tries to promote himself as such a liberal, such a progressive, and he's really not." He said, "Why? Why is he progressive? Because he thinks people should have health care? Boy, that's a radical idea. Because he thinks people should earn a living wage if they work 40 hours a week. They should have enough money to put food on the table. Another radical left-wing idea." He's actually not a radical. He's not a socialist. He's not terribly left-wing. He's actually quite mainstream.
John Kiriakou is our guest. He was invited to speak before the European Parliament, but then taken off the panel today because a supporter of Bernie Sanders, who says she admires John Kiriakou for his human rights stance and the fact that John was unjustly imprisoned in the United States for 2.5 years, she said she couldn't be on the same panel after she checked with headquarters back with the Bernie Sanders movement. They don't want to appear because John Kiriakou is the show host here at Radio Sputnik's Loud and Clear. Another reason I think people should listen to the show. John Kiriakou, if you were on the panel, if you hadn't been excluded, if you hadn't been the victim of this witch hunt, what would you have said?
Well, what I had intended to say was that we have to be vigilant. We have to remain vigilant and make sure that our politicians don't backslide on the issues of torture and that we try to wind down the illegal drone wars that we've initiated under both George W. Bush and Barack Obama, that we have to remain vigilant on human rights and civil liberties and civil rights. It's all very straightforward stuff and, frankly, not at all controversial.
We have 3 minutes left, Walter. Not controversial. John Kiriakou has been denied the right to speak at a European Parliament panel that he was invited to and flew there yesterday to. He was going to say no to torture, no to the drones, no to just allowing these politicians and military officer or brass do whatever they want without accountability. And as a consequence, he's been placed off that panel because his crime is he works for Radio Sputnik's Loud and Clear. I mean, I can't tell you how outraged, John, I was when I heard this. I mean, I was just, I mean, for you, how did you feel as a person?
I was absolutely furious. I feel like I have done things in the public interest that have cost me so dearly that the very least that that ought to buy me is some respect at a conference. And I didn't even get that.
The people who were there who invited you and the people, who, obviously, you're a very, very well-known figure in Greece. You have... You're a Greek American and also have Greek citizenship, but not just in Greece. People all over Europe know you. I mean, what's been the general reaction besides the Americans?
Oh, it's been absolutely positive in every way. I met with members of the European Parliament today from Greece, from Spain, Germany, Ireland. It's just been absolutely positive. And then I had a lovely exchange with the Cuban ambassador to the European Union, who actually went out of her way to introduce herself to me, and we promised to get together for breakfast tomorrow before I leave for the airport to come back to Washington.
You know, it's not an uncommon strategy. We have just about a minute left for progressive people in the United States, for defenders of human rights and civil liberties, to appeal to international bodies when the U.S. government commits these types of violations. It certainly happened in the past, and I think you were carrying on that tradition. You know, in our last 30 seconds, I just wonder if you wanted to comment on that. You know, how can people appeal to the world about the human rights violations that are being committed by this government?
Yeah, that's a good point, Walter. We need to remain vigilant, and we need to exercise our right to seek redress. We need to exercise our right to appeal to these bodies. And as active as the other side is on these issues, we have to be even more active. We have to take to the streets. We have to sign petitions. We have to organize marches and petition our elected officials. We have to make sure that our voices are heard. Otherwise, our voices will be snuffed out.
Yeah, and we have to keep the voice of alternative media alive and well. That was John Kiriakou. He is the co-host of Loud and Clear. We've been speaking to him from Brussels, where he was scheduled to speak and is there still speaking with people in Europe. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short, short break, we will be right back. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back. You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Democrats are jubilant following their victories in last night's election. What does this tell us about the state of politics in the United States? And is the Democratic Party really on solid ground? We're joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese. He's the co-director of Popular Resistance. You can check out their work at popularresistance.org. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thanks for having me on.
So the big takeaway, if you look at the many of the media outlets, is that this was an overwhelming victory for the Democrats. And of course, in many ways, it was. What are your big takeaways?
Well, you know, it's a typical victory for a when there's a Republican in office in the off election year, the Democrats do well, and vice versa when there's a Democrat as president. So it's a Democrats shouldn't get too jubilant, because it really, it's almost like a bipolar disorder. You know, if the Virginia election had gone the other way, they'd be like depressed. So they're not that far from being depressed. But they shouldn't count on this meaning success everywhere. I do think it does show, of course, that there is a Trump backlash, like there is to almost every president, because every president promises more than they deliver, and sometimes it's the reverse of their promises, and Trump is no exception. And so I think for what we're going to start to see in 2018 is more retirements. We already had 30 House Republicans retire. We'll see more of those. The Senate is we'll probably see some there, too, but that's a much tougher fight just because of the different seats that are up and how they went in the last election. I think the Democrats are on a path to actually taking Paul Ryan out as Speaker of the House and taking power in the House. But, again, that's not a big surprise. That's how U.S. elections go in this duopoly system of ping-pong back and forth between one corporate party and the other corporate party. You'll notice people who want to see the Democrats improve should be a little bit concerned about Virginia, for example, and New Jersey. You have a Goldman Sachs, former Goldman Sachs person becoming New Jersey governor. Is that a sign of a progressive new government in Virginia? The new governor is going to be someone who didn't oppose taking people's land away to put in fracked gas pipelines. He came out against sanctuary cities. And so this is not a big shift to a Bernie Sanders or left-wing Democratic Party. This is still within the framework of the corporate duopoly of two corporate parties playing ping-pong back and forth in a very narrow center. And that's what we are seeing as people in the United States. This is not going to solve the problems. It may tone down some of the worst of Donald Trump and the Republicans, but it's not going to really change us in any significant direction toward the kind of country we need, the kind of economy we need, the kind of government we need.
I think those are excellent points, Walter. You know, the superficiality of American media coverage of the elections, or everybody's almost, is like, how many seats do the Democrats need to take in 2018 so that they can have a majority? How many Senate seats, how many House Republicans are retiring? And as Kevin has said, a lot are retiring either because they think they won't be reelected because they're not Trump enough, or because they're just disillusioned, or they want to go into the private sector and make even more money. But there's kind of a superficiality about it. Doesn't really actually matter if we have like Phil Murphy, the New Jersey governor, then we're supposed to be all so happy because now we have a Goldman Sachs Democrat. I mean, like, how does that actually, I don't know, go ahead.
We can think back to the last time that the Democrats retook Congress in a big wave election in 2006, right? And, you know, I mean, they essentially promised that that would mean the end of the Iraq War, right? I mean, even if they didn't go out and say it, that was sort of the implication, and everybody got so excited about it. We're going to deal a blow to Bush, and we're going to deal a blow to the war. And if we can get these Democrats in there, then, you know, we'll be all set. And that obviously didn't do much. And then the excuse became, okay, well, you know, Bush is just going to veto any good thing that they want to do. So we really just need to get a Democratic president in there who will sign all this good stuff that the Democrats in their heart of hearts really want to do. And that happened in 2008. And then between, 2009, 2010, nothing that spectacular happened, right? I mean, there is the Affordable Care Act, but that was a far, far cry from addressing, you know, the scope of change that needs to happen to address the healthcare crisis in the country. The wars continued. The bailouts were not scaled back to any degree. And in fact, there is this permanent life support system for the big bank set up. So yeah, I'm not that excited about the prospect.
Well, you know, your points are really good, because what you see from you go back that far, and we've gone through many changes in government since then, both in Congress and the presidency. And basically, the corporate ship of state is still running in the same direction. Nothing much has changed on the economy, on healthcare, on war. You know, it's the same path. And I look at this in comparison to elections last weekend held in Iceland. where there was a left green candidate who a party that looked like it might actually win the highest vote total. It came in second. But there are now six parties in Iceland that have to form a government. So the ongoing effort in that kind of a non-duopoly system allows this debate to continue past the election. How do we negotiate with each other? How do people's views get represented, you know, throughout the legislative term and through their prime ministership and their premiership as well? And, you know, so it's such a much more vibrant place compared to the United States, which is so the most solid two-party duopoly system in the world, where there's no room really for any alternatives beyond the corporate Democrats and corporate Republicans. And until Trump, both parties were very successful. And Trump, even there's a, he looks one way and is turning on another. But the two parties still have two corporate parties. I mean, the Progressive Caucus is the largest in the Democrat in the House of Representatives. It's primarily Democrats, but it has no power. The establishment Republicans, you know, okay, so now we're replacing the new establishment Republicans, the Trump version, who have the same kind of offshore hiding wealth and the same kind of ripoff economic approaches, the same neoliberalism, the same corporate tax breaks for, you know, big business. You know, so the new establishment Republicans, even though they're Trump-led, are not much different than the older stuff. So we see no change in this country. The duopoly system makes it very hard for new ideas to bubble to the top, makes it very hard for people to be represented in either of these two parties.
That's the voice of Kevin Zeese. He is a co-director of PopularResistance.org. You can read his writings and the writings of other people affiliated with Popular Resistance at their website, popularresistance.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined by Walter Smolarek, sitting in for John Kiriakou. You can hear us every day, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, and also at Sputnik News. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. It's Loud and Clear with Brian Becker. Walter, all of us who are fighting for social change, that would include you, that would include me, that would include Kevin Zeese and the PopularResistance.org, and actually millions of other people in the United States, the question always comes up, what do you do about the elections? I mean, do you orient towards the election, to the electoral process, towards governance as a way to make change, or do you do it outside the electoral system? And of course, there's divided opinion about that. The way the duopoly system is set up, though, and the way American democracy is structured, almost everyone is compelled, at least initially, unless they've actually made a decision not to be, to go in the direction of the elections and the election cycle and trying to get elected as the vehicle for change. There's, because of 2016 and the rise of the Sanders movement and the resurrection, I would say, of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, a lot of progressives and liberals are talking about getting elected. Did any of them get elected in 2016, Walter, in these elections?
Yeah. So there were a few people who were elected who were members of the Democratic Socialists of America organization who identified personally as Democratic Socialists. The one who got the most attention is Lee Carter, who was elected to the Virginia House of Delegates, so the state legislature. And he beat, you know, a prominent Republican in his district. So, you know, people are excited about that. And, you know, of course, it's positive when, you know, anybody who calls themselves a socialist gets more attention because, you know, like we saw in the Bernie Sanders campaign, you know, the demonization of the word socialism. And of course, you know, people on the left who don't have perfect politics aren't the main enemy. But I mean, I was actually excited this morning when I heard about it. I hadn't been following it. And so I went to his website, carterforvirginia.com, and sort of looked there to see what kind of issues he was emphasizing. And then I read his About Lee biography. And so this is a section from it. Lee joined the Marine Corps during the beginning of the global war on terror and worked in technological repair in a special operations capable support unit, completing tours in the Middle East and the Mediterranean. His unit was also one of the first to respond to Haiti following the devastating earthquake in 2010. Throughout Lee's career and civic engagement, his focus has been on helping others, whether that was in his service in the Marine Corps, helping provide cancer and blah, 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 blah. So, I mean, it was disgusting, right? I mean, so the Marine Corps' role in the global war on terror is certainly not to help people, not in Iraq, not in Afghanistan,
Kevin,
definitely not in Haiti.
I mean, that's the other part of it. It seems to me like when liberals or progressives or people who are calling themselves democratic socialists run, they start to run towards what is called the center, but what it really is running towards the establishment to show that they're, you know, that they can play ball. I mean, that's not a real alternative, it doesn't seem like to me.
Well, you know, for me, if you run as a Democrat, I'm not interested. Or as a Republican, obviously, I'm not interested. I mean, to me, if you're in the Democratic Party, you're going to be controlled by the Democratic Party. They have too much power over each candidate. You want poll results, you want no competition, you want fundraising from the Democratic House Committee or the Senate Committee. I mean, so you have to play ball. And I see that with Sanders, too. Like, you know, Sanders' Medicare for All bill is very weak. I think it's so seriously flawed, it's hard for real advocates for single payer to support it, compared to Conyers' bill, which is much better. But so it results in selling out. Unless you break from one of those parties, you really can't represent the people's interests. There's just no room for it. And if someone like a Sanders runs for office, they will be stopped from running for president. They'll be blocked in various ways. So they control, you know, the party. And the party is a corporate-dominated party. It's a Wall Street and war party, and that's what it stands for. So unless you break from that, you're not serious about change.
And the other thing we have to break from, Walter, in addition to formally breaking from the Democratic Party, and I agree with Kevin that that's a party of, you know, it's a control, a party of control. It's a party of Wall Street. It's a party of the military industrial complex. That's clear over and over again. You look at the elites and who they are. You look at their donors and their funders. That's who they are. And we also have to break from social pressure, because the social pressure generated from the sort of ruling class media and organs of opinion molding. We see a lot of liberals and sort of leftists, sort of, I'm emphasizing the word, sort of getting away from now because of the anti-Russia witch hunt. They don't want to touch Russia, where, you know, maybe a year ago they wanted better relations with Russia, which would be a normal thing for a progressive person to want, given the fact that Russia and the United States are the two biggest thermonuclear powers. Breaking from the social pressures may be even harder. What do you think, Walter?
Yeah, I think that's always the question. And unless you have an organizational basis that allows you to do that, you know, unless you have your own sort of set of institutions and infrastructure and positions and base of support, it's extremely difficult, if not impossible.
How do you see it, Kevin Zeese and popularresistance.org? We have about 40 seconds.
The movement is growing. People are breaking from the two parties. When you break from the two parties, you can continue to work as a teacher or a mailman, whatever you want to do, but you will find new people who are aligned with your thinking. And I think that people need to break from those two parties, build those new relationships, and expand the movement. That's the only way we're going to get change.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think that is what's happening. And it's not really reflected in the media. And it's not really reflected, of course, in the media's coverage of the duopoly political institutions in America, which it tries to fixate everyone's opinion on that and sort of not notice this other burgeoning grassroots movement that's going on. Anyway, we're out of time. We've been joined from Baltimore, Maryland by Kevin Zeese. He is the co-director of Popular Resistance. Read his works and the other works there at popularresistance.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
A leaked German government document has revealed that the military strategic planning by that country has taken place with six geopolitical scenarios laid out that could come to pass by 2040. What does the de facto leader of the European Union foresee for the bloc, the European Union, and the world? We are joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international security and affairs analyst. Welcome back, Mark.
Brian, Walter, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Thank you so much for joining. This is from RT, German military study, EU collapse conceivable worst case. Okay, we're talking about six different contingency plans. As I think people who are paying attention know, the Germans are planning for all contingencies, of course, so that doesn't mean that any of these are necessarily likely. But in fact, all of them seem fairly plausible. Tell us, Mark, what the six worst case scenarios are. What's the number one and number two from your point of view?
Okay. Well, first of all, what is to be understood is that this document, Strategic Perspectives. It's a 120-page document. It was created by the German Military Planning Department. It's actually quite standard. Most, significant countries do such contingency planning. That's what this is. And the Strategic Perspectives 2040 imagines six scenarios possible within the next 23 years and how the German military would respond in different situations within these scenarios. And it's not all doom and gloom. Three of the scenarios are actually extremely positive, perhaps too positive, some critics have suggested. They describe domestic bliss and a bored military basically with nothing to do. So three of the six scenarios are actually rosy. Three of the other scenarios are negative. The one that's drawn the most attention is titled "The EU in Disintegration and Germany in Reactive Mode," and this describes a scenario like most of the other three negative ones do, where the international order, the Western-led international order, has begun to fall apart, and that member states have left the EU. Some have left, advancement has stopped, and there's disunion, there is a disagreement within the EU itself. This, of course, is all post-Brexit planning. This is all a reaction to Brexit and so on. Another of the scenarios envisions multipolar competition within the EU itself. This envisions that several states within the EU adopt what is described as a Russian state capitalist model, and there's a rise in extremism in Europe. And this definition of a state capitalist model, I could only imagine that is in comparison to the neoliberal model that the EU, pro-globalization, neoliberal-driven model that the EU has now.
Mark, let me just jump in there and help the audience understand. I mean, some of the terms state capitalism or neoliberal capitalism, in a way, I think, people start to just, unless they're really, really following something, they don't really know what all of it means. What is the difference? And is the Russian economic model a model of state capitalism? And say, compare it to what's actually happening in Germany?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because it's quite unclear what the definition of these economic models that they're describing are, because this is something that is academically contested, and not everyone would identify Russia as state capitalist, or it must be said, not everyone would identify the EU as neoliberal. A state capitalist, I could only imagine, is one similar to the Russian economic model right now, where a large portion, not all, but a large portion of the natural resources, the public utilities, and the strategic sectors like defense are run by state companies. They are largely owned by the state, although, there is some level of privatization in all of them, whereas the rest of the economy, who makes the soap and so on, is all run by private industry. How this exactly differs from the EU, in which a large number of their countries also have state energy companies, state energy monopolies, and so on, and have the defense industry largely falling under, I'm not exactly sure. But certainly the EU goes out of its way to expand free trade agreements in a way that perhaps Russia isn't quite so willing to follow.
Mark, around the time of when the Eurozone crisis was really intense, and I don't believe that it's over, or the problems inside the Eurozone, the group of countries that use the euro common currency, is resolved, But there was, at that time, a few years ago, a pretty popular prescription whereby there would be a two-track Europe set up where there would be, you know, the quote-unquote AAA club of countries with good credit ratings led by Germany that would have, you know, a faster pace of integration. And then the peripheral countries would kind of, you know, be allowed to do their own thing and maybe someday make it into the core club. Is that something that was posited in the strategic planning document? And do you think that that's something that's plausible in the future?
Yeah, the details, like, it has to be said, the document has not been released to the public. Some media, such as Der Spiegel, have been leaked it, I presume, on purpose. So all we have is from their description of it. And there is no definitive information yet whether any of the scenarios include a multiple speed Europe, as it's called, with different levels of integration. But it is speculated that, you know, that is something that could be considered either as an attempt to halt disintegration or, conversely, that the attempt to follow this multiple speed Europe actually backfires and leads to more disintegration of Europe as countries are separated into different groups with different rights and then different levels of responsibility and so on. I think we have to consider that there are, you know, multiple factors that are affecting the unity of the EU at this part. And the third scenario that we didn't talk about was west to the east, where several EU Central and East European members join an Eastern bloc, perhaps with Russia or perhaps on their own. But there's definitely Western, Eastern, and Northern-Southern discord within the EU. Northern-Southern discord is largely economic, and the Western-Eastern discord is largely over social issues, with the East adopting more conservative populist politics, while the West is pushing an extreme postmodern liberal and a neoliberal model quite forcefully on the East, which is leading to problems between the European Commission and governments in Poland, in Hungary, in Slovakia, and some of the hot issues that are really driving this dissent in Eastern Europe are LGBT rights and gay marriage, but also migration. Migration is a major issue. And there's multiple ways they use to push this, the European Commission, the Council of Europe, the European Court of Human Rights. The European Court of Human Rights, part of the Council of Europe, has 47 members. 36 of the members are not enacting judgments by the European Court of Human Rights, to the tune of 9,944 judgments that are not being carried out by a vast majority of the countries in Europe. And this is, many argue, because that the European Court of Human Rights is being used politically to push a political and ideological agenda on countries which are not willing to obey it. And this has led to countries like Britain and Russia, which is part of the Council of Europe and the European Court of Human Rights, talking about withdrawing from it. And a breakup of the Council of Europe at different levels would only presage then a further breakup of the EU, particularly on the eastern-western lines between Western Europe and Central and Eastern Europe.
Mark, let me ask you about another contingency, which I actually don't believe it's one of the six, but, you know, would have some historical plausibility, which is that the German economy and the German government itself reorient towards the East, in other words, towards Russia, rather than taking the position of junior partner with the United States and maintaining the, you know, sort of long distance animus towards Russia or before it, the Soviet Union. Germany returned to an earlier period in its history, which was quite integrated into and oriented towards relations with Russia. What do you think about that as a plausible scenario?
Yeah, you're talking about some kind of Ostpolitik scenario, Eastern politics, as it's called in Germany. No, it certainly wasn't considered in this six military scenarios, but I think it was, to many people, too horrific to even be considered. The German establishment right now is very largely anti-Russian. And even the, you know, traditional socialist party of Germany, the SPD, has been moving further away from these positions in recent years. And while we have seen former German foreign prime ministers or chancellors like Gerhard Schroeder and others move, you know, try to push Germany further in a cooperative, good relations move towards Russia, they haven't met much success. In fact, all of the movement has been in the opposite direction. Now, this has led to some discontent, especially with the sanctions regime, by a large number of German businesses who were really looking at growth in Russia as improving their economic situation, and they've been largely cut off from that. And they see other countries like China quickly moving in to take the place and then perhaps permanently locking them out of that market, even if sanctions are one day removed. It's led to some discontent, but this is mostly on the business level, and we haven't really seen it reflected in politics. Politics is going the other direction. So I think they're probably right not to consider that as a probable scenario in the near future.
We have just about 1 minute left. Do you think that Germany and France are going to be partners that are tied together by the intensity of the crisis facing the European Union, or will they revert to their more traditional roles as rivals for European hegemony?
Yeah, I think they're kind of locked together for the near future, although it must be said, as a reaction to Brexit and the migration crisis and then the other problems that are going on, the new French president, Macron, the neoliberal globalist banker, is really pushing towards a further integration of Europe, especially on economic grounds, talking about a joint finance ministry and an EU army and more coordinated foreign policy as if the EU was some super state, while Germany is bucking against this, especially on the economic terms, which would see more of Germany's money sent out to the less affluent periphery nations like Greece, etc. So there is now some division between Germany and France. I don't think we're going to see the further integration as kind of a reaction to this. But I don't see that we're going to see beyond that much light of day between them. They are Europe. If Germany and France ever have real division, that would be the end of the EU completely.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He is an international security and affairs analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a very short break, we will be right back. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back. You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Who's the real conspiracy theorist? The latest theme in the Russiagate frenzy is that anyone who questions the official narrative is on the fringe, unworthy of serious consideration. We're joined from Minnesota by Colleen Rowley. She is a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. Welcome back, Colleen.
Yes, thanks for having me.
So, Colleen Rowley, let's talk about this new phenomenon. I think the thing that sparked it was that Bill Binney and Mike Pompeo had a meeting to talk about his assertion that, you know, the DNC leak was, the DNC episode was a leak and not a hack. And then it sort of ballooned out from there to target other dissidents from Russiagate. Tell us what you make of that episode.
Well, the first thing I think is that it's good for someone like Pompeo, who is the director of the CIA, but has little, does not have that great a background in intelligence gathering and is fairly new at the job, and certainly would not be necessarily privy to everything that went into the prior intelligence collection slash assessment under the Obama administration. And, you know, who knows if he's even seen all of the stuff that went on in 2016. We would hope so. We would hope that as director now, he's been given access to everything. But, you know, so the good news on this was that the ability for him to maybe learn something that might even help him ask more intelligent questions or may prod him to ask for more documentation about something. So that was good. And Bill Binney he's one of the smartest mathematicians that the NSA ever employed and actually rose in the organization to be a director of one of the more tech-oriented and technical innovative units that he was working on. So if anybody would, I think, be able to help the CIA director, at least, like I said, think more intelligently, maybe ask more intelligent questions about this, it would be Bill Binney. That was the good side. The downside is the mainstream press reaction to anyone that questions or even, you know, could even pose a pretty narrow question about some aspect of this so-called Russiagate narrative. And I think that's where we've really gone into kind of the loony bin, just to put it lightly, where anyone, and actually I've seen Ron Paul say something quite similar with respect to all of these entities now that are calling everything fake news, and they're all paid for by certain neocon war hawk groups, but they're labeling anybody who even goes on RT or Sputnik as a so-called useful idiot. So some of this is just going off the deep end. And to me, it really harkens back to the early 1950s and during the McCarthy era. The good news is this won't probably last real long. You know, maybe it will only be a couple, 3 years. But for the people who get caught up in this kind of thing, and, you know, kind of with this latest example being Bill Binney, it can be very destructive and devastating to them, you know, especially if they're younger and are trying to get employment like those Hollywood writers and producers that were blacklisted back in the 1950s as having some connection to, you know, some tenuous connection to communism, or someone like Pete Seeger, you know, amazing folk singer that had to suffer for years and years and couldn't even sing again on television for many, many years. So that kind of thing is repeating, and there's many, many downsides to that kind of unthinking, you know, wanting to label things as and demonize, oh, you're connected with the enemy, and therefore nothing you say can make sense. If you're against war, of course, then it must be the Russians that are making you say this, etc. That was Ron Paul's spiel the other day. Anyway, I just think it's very unfortunate, because there is a very good side in this case, which is that the director of the CIA should have full access and should be aware, should be made aware of potential issues and potential questions. And I think that's what Bill Binney was attempting to do in this meeting. He did get to meet with him for an hour, so it's perhaps there's a hopeful sign that maybe Pompeo will dig into this more and try to see what may be valid and what isn't valid in this whole Russiagate, a lot of which does seem specious. But to me, it seems specious on many levels, and it's almost gone too far. And certainly when they're trying to shut down Facebook and Twitter and Google is censoring. And I just heard another tale this morning of someone whose Facebook post was taken down from Huffington for merely chronicling the Russiagate and how it's proceeded. Everything in that article was factual, but Huffington didn't want it and took it down. This is crazy.
Yeah, you're totally right, Colleen. We're speaking to Colleen Raleigh. She was named in 2002 Time Magazine Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. She is a former FBI special agent and whistleblower. The person we're talking about, William Binney, Bill Binney, was the technical director of the NSA for many, many decades. He was there for many decades. He wasn't a technical director, but a very high position at the time he left as a whistleblower when he was trying to expose what he considered to be wrongdoing and corruption at the NSA. Afterwards, Bill Binney was targeted by law enforcement as a consequence of his whistleblowing. FBI agents raided his home, burst into his bathroom while he was taking a shower, stuck a gun in his face. Eventually, the government didn't succeed with prosecuting him. Bill Binney's been on this show loud and clear multiple times, and his argument is, and he is an NSA technical director, that the so-called hack of the Democratic National Committee email servers that was purportedly done by Russian hackers and given to WikiLeaks that exposed and showed how Hillary Clinton and the DNC were breaking the rules of the Democratic National Committee when it came to the primaries. He has argued that this was not a hack, that it was an inside job, that it was a leak, and he's based his argument on a technical understanding of how the NSA could have deciphered or understood exactly who took and who was delivered to the actual hack, but could not have understood it otherwise if it was a leak. In other words, he says the NSA, if it was a hack, would be able to identify who did the job, who did the hack. So now Mike Pompeo, at the urging of Trump, met with Bill Binney, the former technical director, to understand what Binney's argument is. In other words, that's the point. Does Binney have an argument to make or not? And as Colleen is saying, and just so our audience knows, because Bill Binney has a different narrative of what happened to the Democratic National Committee emails, the mainstream media, are now demonizing Bill Binney as like a lunatic, like a conspiracy nutcase, or somebody who is on the fringe, when he's one of the most respected people in the United States for anyone who cares about truth and accountability. I mean, that's how I view it anyway, Colleen.
Yeah, I think there's another problem here in a wider sense, which is when the government does these things, when we talk about deep state and even cover-ups, even things like, for instance, classifying the 28 pages that show Saudi Arabia was involved with the 9/11 attacks. Now, when the government does engage in those kinds of cover-ups and tries to shut down certain messages, et cetera, what are people to think? So this wider thing is that people do naturally grow more suspicious of government when they realize that the government is trying to keep these secrets and in many cases for no good valid reason. Look what happened recently with releasing the JFK documents. And, you know, there was a delay of a week on some of the documents. Well, immediately people, American citizens, naturally think, oh, you must be hiding something that you don't want me to know. Of course, that's what people are naturally going to think, because they're not going to say, well, if they're saying, what in the heck could still be that top secret that they would have to still continue to hold these? So people naturally get more and more suspicious. And there have been cases where conspiracy is probably the term that has a bad connotation. But certainly you do find out that wrongdoing, there's a natural tendency on the part of officials who have been who have not only maybe engaged in their own wrongdoing and sometimes just negligence, that they don't want to come forth and tell, you know, be own up to it and tell the truth about things. That's a lot of the 9/11 that I know about.
When I'm looking at the NBC coverage that's sort of demonizing or making everyone think that Bill Binney is a nutcase, here's some of the language. This is how outrageous it is, because and I think people, you know, they sort of go with the narrative of whatever the story is as presented by the media rather than actually thinking about it. Here's what the NBC says about Bill Binney. Binney left the agency, meaning the NSA, in 2000 and has become a self-styled whistleblower, making unsupported claims that the NSA is collecting and storing nearly every U.S. communication. Now, what do you mean unsupported claim? As if Bill Binney is like howling in the wind. We now know that the NSA is doing exactly that. and without Edward Snowden's revelations. And Snowden said, by the way, that he had to leave the country and do it the way he did it because he learned the lesson of other whistleblowers and how persecuted they became, including Bill Binney. We know that that Bill Binney's assertions were absolutely true and that the government was absolutely not telling the truth. And yet the NBC says a self-styled whistleblower making unsupported claims. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, how do you say it's an unsupported claim when the government itself now acknowledges it to be true?
You know, what I see is that for the Trump phenomenon has really made people forget so quickly what they actually even knew a couple of years ago. It's almost like we live in the United States of amnesia. And so when Snowden revelations came out with the documents actually proving, very much confirming things that Bill Binney and Tom Drake had said, there was, at least on the left, on the liberal side, most everyone very much understood that quite quickly.
And we were all applauding. Everybody was applauding.
Well, that's right. And people said, oh, this massive surveillance. I wrote an op-ed that was published on CNN. Two days after Snowden's first disclosures, I got an op-ed published on CNN about this massive surveillance. And again, I think at least 60% of the United States, if you took a poll, would have been very concerned, saying, you know, why are you spying on Americans, etc. You get this Trump, and of course, this is what elections have this tendency to do. It occurred with the Obama election, where people changed their minds real quickly, depending on their partisan loyalties, and it happened again with Trump's election. And so right afterwards, everyone is so eager to fall on the side of again, thinking that they're going to try to impeach Trump and all the Hillary should have won, all of this, that they actually get kind of... You talked about thinking, that the critical thinking and even the memory of what I thought from a year ago or 2 years ago just goes up in smoke because this emotional loyalty supplants the critical thinking ability. And I think that's, you know, Orwell wrote about this and other people have written about how easy it is when you press people's emotional buttons. And I think that's Joe McCarthy. If you really want to talk about pressing emotional buttons, there's your prime example.
We're out of time, Colleen Rowley. We're out of time. We've been joined from Minnesota by Colleen Rowley. In 2002, she was named Time Magazine Person of the Year. She is a former FBI special agent. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.